This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Beyond Natural Pet Food. Beyond Pet Food helps me care for what matters, my pets and my world. They help me nourish my pets with high-quality natural ingredients like wild-caught salmon and organic free-range chicken. Beyond also has responsible sourcing practices and a long-term partnership with the Nature Conservancy. Beyond Pet Food, your pet, your world. Learn more at beyondpetfood.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
Hello, I'm Dan Hill, the host of Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's guest is Tom Hartman. He is a four-time winner of the Project Censored Award, a New York Times best-selling author of 32 books, and America's number one progressive talk radio show host. His show is syndicated for Sirius XM, as well as local stations from coast to coast. It's simulcast on the Free Speech TV network nationwide. Tom, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Dan. It's great to be here.
Well, this is certainly an important topic and one rife with emotions. How is it that we have such a terrible predicament with healthcare in the country? Obamacare was supposedly going to clean things up for us, but obviously we haven't gotten there.
Well, as a starting point, every other developed country in the world at various times, starting with Germany in 1884, when they developed their first single-payer healthcare system under Otto von Bismarck, when it was the German Empire, has defined healthcare as a right rather than a privilege. And when a government defines something as a right, it becomes the obligation of the government to make sure that that right is met, is acknowledged, is brought into being, or at the very least is protected. And we've never done that here in the United States. We still define healthcare as a privilege. If you've got enough money, you get it. If you don't have enough money, you're toast. And so as a starting point, every effort that we have made to, to somehow provide healthcare to people has always been outside of that frame of rights, and therefore within the frame of who can make a buck off this. Because, you know, privileges, like you have the privilege of owning a car, which means, hey, any car manufacturer can try to get your business and somebody can make a buck off selling you a car. So as a consequence of that, our government has, not done a particularly good job of making sure that everybody has health care.
Sure.
The genesis of this largely goes back to the late 1800s. I mentioned in 1884, Otto von Bismarck got healthcare for the German Empire. Around that same time, that same decade, a young German man by the name of Frederick Ludwig Hoffmann traveled from Germany to the United States at the age of 17, arrived here with $5 in his pocket, you know, the classic kind of immigrant story. And he was a genius with numbers. And he got a job with the Prudential Life Insurance Company, the largest insurance company in America at the time, and started running numbers on things that would interest them in terms of writing life insurance policies, and found, for example, he's the guy who discovered the statistical association between tobacco smoking and lung cancer, between exposure to asbestos and mesothelioma, between fibrosis of the lungs and working in cotton mills. He also discovered the association between a diet high in processed foods and dozens of different kinds of cancers. He wrote a book about that is still in print. So he was well regarded and a relatively famous guy in the late 1800s and the first three decades of the 20th century. He applied these skills on behalf of Prudential. Prudential at the time was just beginning to write life insurance policies for Black people. And so he decided to figure out what was going on with Black people in America, ran the numbers and found that Black people were dying and getting sick at much higher rates than were white people on a per capita basis. And came to two conclusions out of this, which he published in a book that was published the same year that the Plessy versus Ferguson decision gave us legal apartheid in the United States, 1896. His book was titled Race, Traits, and Tendencies of the American Negro. And the conclusion he drew was, from all of his number crunching, was that, number one, Blacks were genetically inferior to whites, profoundly genetically inferior, and that without whites helping them, Blacks would die out. In fact, he made the assertion that Blacks and African Americans were much healthier during slavery than they were post-slavery. Keep in mind, this was after the failure of Reconstruction. And then number two, therefore, if white people simply made sure that Black people never had access to health care in the United States, that would, quote, solve the race problem in America, end quote, by causing the black race, as it were, in this country to die out. And he published this book. He traveled around the country giving speeches on this. Prudential started charging Black people much higher prices for life insurance than white people. That persisted, by the way, until the 1960s. His theories became the basis of the American Eugenics Program that was started by President Woodrow Wilson in the 1920s, or in the 19-teens, rather, excuse me. And carried through in the 1920s, that itself became the basis for Hitler's Final Solution and his racial and eugenics theories. So when Teddy Roosevelt in 1912 proposed a national healthcare system as part of his Square Deal, the blowback was, but what about Frederick Hoffman's proof that, you know, we have to deny healthcare to Black people? How are you going to do that? And that killed Teddy Roosevelt's program. Same thing when Franklin Roosevelt proposed this in 1936. That was the blowback, but we don't want Black people to have it. In 1947, when Harry Truman actually tried to get a single-payer system into and through Congress, that was the blowback. We don't want Black people covered. And the same thing happened in 1961 when John Kennedy proposed it. And in 1965, when Lyndon Johnson finally got Medicare through, the white Southern racist senators came forward and said, there needs to be a bar set in Medicare, even though we're talking about Black people over 65, they're still Black people. There needs to be a bar set high enough that most Black people will not be able to afford to show up at our hospitals and use Medicare. And that's why there's a 20% gap. Medicare Part B only covers 20% of hospitalization costs, was to discourage Black people from using it. So those theories really influenced the discussion and debate in the United States uniquely. This discussion was not happening in any other developed country in the world from the 1880s right up until the 1980s. And then in 83, Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, and we went from hundreds of small insurance companies, life insurance or health insurance companies, to about a dozen major ones. And what that did is it turned it into a very profitable, very politically powerful industry that literally generates $1 billion in profits every week. And
wow, $1 billion a week. Wow.
Yeah. And in an industry that size and that powerful, can easily squash any politician who wants to give everybody in America, you know, health care without giving profits to the health insurance companies, squash them like a bug. So from 1880 to 1980, it was all about race. And from 1980 to now, it's all about
money.
Profits.
Yeah. Going back to the race part with Hoffman, if I remember right from the book, he married into a Georgia family.
Yes.
Did that just merely reinforce his racism? Did he bring it from Germany? I mean, he seems instrumental. I mean, to tie into eugenics is pretty horrific.
Well, actually eugenics was kind of created on the foundation of Hoffman's work. It was just conventional wisdom at the time. It was referred to as scientific racism, and that was not a pejorative. That was, you know, a kind of scientific anthropology, you know. It was widely held in the United States in the 1880s and 1890s when he wrote Race Traits that blacks were inferior, that there was an evolutionary hierarchy that started with Africans out of Africa and that hit its peak with Caucasians in Scandinavia, and thus the whole Aryan race thing. So he wasn't outside of the mainstream.
Sure.
I'm guessing that the Southern belle that he married, who had a kind of a plantation background, certainly didn't
dissuade him from that course. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. but I think he was more simply echoing the sentiments of the time.
Sure. So if we jump to Obamacare, because of course it was notable that particularly the Southern Republican governors tended to not want to enroll. Is that to be taken as seemingly wanting to deny blacks once again, you know, expanded healthcare coverage?
I think that's a good piece of it. I mean, there are 12 states that have refused to expand Medicaid, and all of them, there may be a single exception to that, were former slave states. And 60% of all African Americans live in the South, in one fairly concentrated geographic area. And that, the South is where Medicare has absolutely not been expanded. And, you know, they still fight it from Texas to Florida. And so I'm of the opinion, I have nothing to base this on, because senators and members of Congress no longer stand up and give speeches about race, like they did in the 60s. But I would guess that that's probably still a very large part of it.
Yeah, no, it makes sense to me that that's the unspoken part of the compact here, as heinous as it is. Paul Krugman, who I always admire the columns of, suggests that part of what's going on here with healthcare and so many other things is that the Republicans don't want government to actually improve the lives of people for fear the government gets a greater mandate and more opportunity to make requests of the rich donors that help support the Republican Party. How much you mentioned the incredible lobbying power of the insurance industry. How about the perspective of rich donors and whether or not they are an additional blockage to this desire for healthcare?
It's a mutual interest society, Dan. The health insurance industry doesn't want to lose their profits.
Sure.
For very wealthy people, even very expensive health insurance is just a drop in the bucket in terms of their annual or monthly expenses. So they don't really care, and they don't want their taxes increased. And it would every proposal for Medicare for all, and frankly every country in the world that funds healthcare through some sort of single payer system, does have higher taxes on very, very wealthy people as a way of paying for the healthcare for pretty much everybody else. And Medicare for all in the United States would be no exception to that. It wouldn't be onerous. I mean, we're not even talking about raising taxes back to where they were when Ronald Reagan came into office. In fact, we're talking about less than half of that, personal income taxes. They were 74% when Reagan came into office. They're at 36% or 35% right now. And the proposal that Congress is looking at is raising them to 39%. And that's only in the top tax bracket. That's only for people making more than $400,000 a year. So, you know, how this is going to play out, I'm not sure, but they're absolutely, you know, you've identified a mutuality of interests here.
Yeah. And disinterest in other human beings, unfortunately.
Yeah.
The on page 121, you have something I think is really striking and merits a good discussion explanation by yourself. That's the idea that we could actually take the 10 largest publicly traded insurance companies, and based on their market capitalization, we'd be better off just essentially buying them even at a slightly inflated price because we'd all accrue the benefit. Can you explain that a bit further than I did?
Yeah, it's a way of dealing with the fact that every time somebody starts talking about, you know, a national healthcare program that would diminish the size, profits, or even the existence of the health insurance industry, the industry responds by just pouring hundreds of millions of dollars down the throats of politicians all across the United States and mobilizing its PR army of op-ed writers and think tanks. And that's a significant and formidable obstacle to try to take on, as Barack Obama discovered, which is why Obamacare embraced the insurance companies rather than, you know, kicking them to the side, as would have been much more efficient for the United States. The average American family spends right now $3,000 a year more for healthcare than do the citizens of any other developed country. You know, Canadians save almost $4,000 a year compared to us. So my thought was, how do we get around this? How do we stop the big health insurance companies from trying to block this? And, you know, one strategy, the so-called free market strategy, would just be to go to the New York Stock Exchange and the various exchanges where their stock is traded and buy it, just buy all their stock. And if you add them all up, it comes to about $700 billion and, you know, toss in some extra for expenses and for retraining and relocating their employees and for some of the smaller companies that might be harder to buy. Unless you go, you know, you cut a one-on-one deal with them. And I figured, you know, at worst, it's going to cost $1 trillion, which is just like the first year of the Trump tax cuts. So, you know, it's not something that's outside of the possibility of what the American government could pull off.
Oh, no, definitely the government would have the resources and the means to pull it off. Since stocks can be bought and taken majority shares, is there any way this could be done even outside the government, just perhaps?
It would take, you know, it would require somebody or some group of people who have access. If you just want to buy majority shares so that you could, you know, kind of just undermine the companies from within or something like that, you could do it for $500 billion or less. But it would be a pretty expansive conspiracy that would involve a whole lot of cash. I doubt that's going
to
happen.
Could you break one company in the cartel by targeting one to seek to take over and change the dynamics of the industry, perhaps? I don't know. I realize it's a
pipe
dream.
That's a question to put to a corporate raider, you know, to somebody like that who does that for a living.
Sure. Let's turn to a different angle on this, trying to, you know, get to a better outcome for people. Doctors and their compensation. Your book certainly suggests that they are, in the United States, wildly overpaid compared to the rest of the world. I think I'm quoting you directly on that.
It depends. I would say pediatricians, general practitioners are wildly underpaid. Psychiatrists, wildly underpaid.
So certain specialists, in other words.
Yeah, but there are specialties in the United States where doctors are making obscene amounts of money and, you know, way out of proportion to the services they're providing. And you know, you can just compare that with every other country in the world. And frankly, I would much rather go to a doctor who went into medicine because they believed that it was their calling in life to heal people than to go to a doctor who went into medicine because it was a quick way to make a couple million dollars and retire at the age of 60 or 50. You know, I lived in Germany for a year, and the place where I lived had a little health clinic attached to it. And I got to know this one particular physician there, Dr. Gier, quite well. And one day I asked him, you know, how much do you make? And he said, I mean, this was in euros at the time, or maybe it was Deutschmarks. In fact, this was 1986. He said, as I recall, around $110,000 or $120,000 a year. And I said, wow, doctors in America make a lot more than that. And he's like, you know, it's a good pay. He said, this is, you know, pretty much the average in Germany. It's you know, high end. It's what lawyers make. It's what, you know, other people make. It's, and I think now in Germany, they're probably making about twice that. But, you know, in most countries, doctors are not multimillionaires.
Okay. Yeah.
They are uniquely here.
Yeah. And how about the hospital empires? I mean, there's been some blowback lately. The New York Times, for instance, was reporting, you know, wildly different compensation rates for the same procedure in hospitals. And yet it's you know, it's all tremendously opaque normally.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, the hospital industry has become a for-profit industry too. You know, back in the 70s, I owned an herbal tea company in outside of Lansing, Michigan, in Okemos, Michigan. And we had 18 employees and, you know, we bagged up and sold herbal teas all over the country. And I bought health insurance for all of my employees. And I remember, you know, I wrote the checks every month and it was $35 per person per month. And it was that cheap because in Michigan at that time, the law required all hospitals to be not-for-profits, to be nonprofits. There were three hospitals in the Lansing area: Ingham Medical, which was run by the county, St. Lawrence, which was owned by the Catholic Church, and Sparrow Hospital, which had been endowed by a guy named Mr. Sparrow, who was one of the co-founders of Oldsmobile back in the day, and this was his legacy. But they were all nonprofit. And the health insurance companies were required by law in Michigan in the 70s to be nonprofits. And so we had Blue Cross Blue Shield, and it was a nonprofit. And the system worked actually fairly well. You know, health insurance was not a huge burden for people. It was not a huge burden for employers. It worked well. You didn't, you know, the health insurance companies didn't make you jump through 300 hoops to get healthcare.
Yeah.
The hospitals didn't screw you at every opportunity. Because, you know, with a nonprofit, your first obligation is to do what the mission of the nonprofit is, you know, to care for people or to pay for the care of people. With a for-profit, your first mission is to make a buck, and you do whatever is necessary to make that happen. It's very unfortunate that the Reagan, you know, a big part of the Reagan Revolution was to undo those. Pretty much every state in the union had laws similar to Michigan's requiring nonprofit hospitals and nonprofit insurance companies, and that's all a thing of the past.
Yeah, no, it honestly drives me crazy when people think that fail to look at the dark undersides of the so-called Reagan Revolution. As I read the book, since this is a program about, you know, EQ, emotional intelligence, and emotional dynamics, it was it's a very good book. It's a very tough book to read because, as you've alluded to earlier, we kind of had two stages in those who were opposed. And the first one started out with, you know, racial animosity, if not outright hatred and condescension. And then we move into the 80s and beyond, and we have greed and players who don't seem to be shamed no matter what. And on the other side, for most ordinary Americans, you have a combination of fear that this could drive them into bankruptcy and wondering what in the world's going on. So there's anxiety combined with the sadness because it seems like there's no chance for reforms at times, that we have such powerful players involved that we're not going to get to a better place, and yet we should. So left with both rage and despair, at least that's my reaction in reading the book, and not against you, obviously, but against the status quo. Any parting words that you can offer here?
This is a political problem, and you summed it up very, very well there, Dan. It's a political problem. It's going to take a political solution, and it's a very, you know, the idea of providing everybody with healthcare has gone beyond the novelty phase of Obamacare and the Tea Party and all that stuff. And we've all seen that the death panels never materialized, and grandma's doing just fine. And so I think a large chunk of the public, and certainly virtually the entire Democratic Party, are ready for this. And you know, if you poll these kinds of things, they poll out between 65% and 80%, depending on how you ask the question. You know, do you think that the government should provide health care to everybody in America? If you add in words like in Canada or like in every other developed country in the world, it polls even higher in most. It depends on, you know, where and who, but generally speaking. So I think that this is ultimately an issue that we're going to have to solve through politics. And to that end, there are a bunch of groups: National Nurses United, Physicians for National Healthcare, one of the largest doctors' organizations in the country, is calling for single-payer healthcare. National Nurses United, which is either the largest or the second largest nurses union in the United States, calling for national healthcare. Obviously, the Democratic Party, the majority of elected officials in the Democratic Party are in favor of this. And even a few Republicans, you know, so I think it's coming. I really do. And I hope that this book is a contribution to that dialogue.
Sure. Well, and in fact, in a time of COVID-19 and counting, we're going to be up to COVID-22 here, unfortunately, quite shortly. It seems like it's almost racketed up even more. We're back to doubting science itself, which you know, I would have thought was at least somewhat acceptable in some of those Southern circles a century ago, but maybe not.
I'm not sure that they doubt it because, you know, the minute that they get sick, where do they go?
True.
They go to the hospital. They don't go to the veterinarian's
office. Well, they doubt it for public consumption. Let's put it that way.
There you go.
Yeah. So I want to thank you so much. This has been the episode, For-Profit Health Insurance is a Con Job. My guest, Tom Hartman. I am your host, Dan Hill, for Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight here on the New Books Network. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks, Dan. It's been a pleasure being here with you.
Okay, thank you.